Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. Whether it's helping a single mom in Dundalk keep her home or giving a bright student in Sandtown a chance to be his best, United Way fights for families. Help them win the fight. Visit uwcm.org/fight.
This is Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun with episode 440 of the Roughly Speaking podcast. Today, I want to tell you about the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project, an effort to remember the victims of the most gruesome of racial crimes during the 19th and into the 20th centuries. In fact, October 18th marks 85 years since the last of Maryland's 40 recorded lynchings took place. The last victim was a young black man named George Armwood. He was lynched by a mob in Princess Anne in Somerset County, Maryland, in October 1933. His lynching came 2 years after another on Maryland's eastern shore, that of Matthew Williams in Salisbury. The Maryland Lynching Memorial Project follows along with a national project that seeks to remember more than 4,000 victims across the country. To get American cities and small towns to acknowledge this disturbing history of racial prejudice and terror wrought by white supremacists over the decades after the Civil War.
Next, of the stains left on our national heritage by the country's history of slavery and Jim Crow segregation, perhaps the least discussed is the practice of racial lynchings, executions of African Americans done outside the judicial system and often intended to subdue black communities into passivity.
The plan is to commemorate victims of racially motivated lynchings with a memorial in Montgomery, Alabama. The design calls for some 800 columns, which upon closer viewing reveal themselves to be suspended from above in a way that mimics a hanging. Each will bear the names of lynching victims, over 4,000 in all, as well as the date and locations of their deaths. A companion courtyard will hold duplicate columns, which will be moved to the county of the lynchings each commemorates once that local community accepts it.
The National Memorial, which opened in Montgomery, Alabama in the spring, is led by civil rights attorney and advocate Brian Stevenson, the founder of the nonprofit Equal Justice Institute. We'll hear from Brian Stevenson in this episode of Roughly Speaking, but my main guest today is Will Schwartz, a longtime Baltimore television and video producer who is founder of the Maryland Memorial Project. Will is an old friend and colleague of mine. He's done a lot of work on this already. For one thing, he got the Sun to give Maryland's lynching history some attention, and the result is a multimedia project that went online and in print a couple of weeks ago. You can find links to Jonathan Pitts' story and Carl Merton Ferran's fine photos and videos, along with an interactive map, at BaltimoreSun.com. Will got me to give lynching in Maryland some attention on this podcast, too. He also started the collection of soil from the grounds where Maryland lynchings occurred. That's part of the National Memorial Project. Soil in glass jars, collected from the places, including the lawns of county courthouses, where mobs of racist whites lynched black men and sometimes women and children. This past Saturday, the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project organized a day of remembrance, reflection, and reckoning at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum in Baltimore. During that conference, Will Schwartz screened a 17-minute documentary on the lynching of George Armwood. We're going to hear some excerpts from it today. You'll also hear commentary from a PBS NewsHour interview with Brian Stevenson. We start the conversation with Will Schwartz. His interest in lynching was brought about by Stevenson and his 2014 memoir, Just Mercy. It was the Equal Justice Initiative led by Stevenson that a year later published a report documenting 3,959 lynchings in 12 southern states between 1877 and 1950. Additional research increased the total number of black racial terror victims to 4,084 in the southern states and 300 in other states, including Maryland, in that same time period.
They did this big report on lynching in America, but it was concentrated on the 12 southern states where most of these occurred. Maryland was mentioned, but it wasn't really a focus. So I thought someone should be doing this work in Maryland, and I'm a filmmaker, and I thought it would be an interesting story.
What about it turned you on or inspired you to do something? Is it the absence of any remembrance of this? That this is like a ghost story from our past that There hasn't been a full accounting for it in Maryland?
Yes. Two features of American exceptionalism are denial and arrogance. And I think this story, the fact that it doesn't get attention, is an example of both. So there was that. I think it was an overlooked and a part of the history that needs to be told. But beyond that, it continues to affect our lives. I mean, it's impossible. To me, it's easy to draw a straight line between the acceptance of lynching as a mode of justice and cops shooting black people in the back. To me, that's a straight line. And that's why I think it's so important. And there are other ways in which it still, you know, institutional racism still grips the country.
In this country, in the states of the old South, we execute people. We are 11 times more likely to get the death penalty if the victim is white than if the victim is black, 22 times more likely to get it if the defendant is black and the victim is white. In the very states where there are buried in the ground the bodies of people who were lynched, and yet there is this disconnect.
To me, it's an exercise in developing empathy. I don't think it should be that hard to take a look at this awful, shameful history and begin to understand how it continues to influence our lives and want to do something about it and want to recognize it, right? It's about justice and dignity. That shouldn't be that hard for people.
I think a lot of people think of lynchings as being associated with the southern states, the states of the old Confederacy, and with the 19th century, with post-Civil War, post-Reconstruction, the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, but not 1933 Eastern Shore, Princess Anne, or 1931 Salisbury, Maryland. It's not that far away.
People are alive today who were alive then when that happened. And certainly survivors of people who were lynched, family members. We had Tina Johnson in this film we did about Armwood, who is the first cousin, twice removed, of George Armwood. Her grandmother told her the story. Her grandmother was there.
An elderly woman named Mary Denston said she was attacked by a black man while walking home near Princess Anne. She said she didn't know her assailant, but would be able to identify him among a thousand. Word of the attack spread quickly. Soon, hundreds of men from three counties joined the manhunt. The man they were hunting was George Armwood, a 22-year-old farm worker who lived near Pocomoke City.
My grandmother's name is Mary Armwood. You know, it was her family, it was her relative, and she was there.
Tina's grandmother had fond memories of her cousin.
He would come by a lot, and he seemed like a really nice guy. He was always smiling. He was very friendly, and she said he used to whistle a lot.
When he was 15, George left school to live and work with a white man on a nearby farm. Armwood, the Afro learned, was reared by a white family and recognized by many to be feeble-minded and a fit subject for a psychopathic ward. He was not put in one because, in spite of his mental infirmity, or because of it, he was a good workman and an inexpensive one. Even before Mrs. Denston had a chance to identify him, Armwood was named as her attacker. It's not clear why.
I can give my reaction to your film. Seeing it for the first time on Saturday, it was not just the raw violence, it's the utter helplessness of the man. We don't even know if Armwood did what he was accused of doing. We don't even know if Matthew Williams did what he did. But those folks, that mob wanted them dead, that they could be capable of such violence against a human being, told me that they didn't regard him as a human being. And I found it so pathetic and sad.
Some men brought heavy rails and rammed the gate repeatedly until it finally gave way at 8:30. A howl arose from the mob when the gate went down. Armwood was found hiding under the mattress in his cell on the second floor. He was dragged outside, a noose already around his neck. The frenzied mob taunted and beat the helpless prisoner. A boy of 18 cut Armwood's ear off and waved it around. It was described as a bloody carnival in which men, women, and even children took part.
Yes, it was a family affair. It wasn't just men,
but it was women, and they knew in advance what was going to happen.
These were men dressed in suits, respectable men in their 30s. I mean, you have accounts from the time that are in the paper, and women and children. It was a celebration. It's appalling. It's hideous. It's impossible to imagine. And then the other thing that kind of gets to me is the humanity of George Armwood himself.
So the Armwood lynching, just as the Matthew Williams lynching, went without anyone being charged.
Yeah, so basically nothing happened. So business as usual. But someone had lost their life. Family members lost a loved one.
Presses her hand and talks, talking to Somerset County, still reaping the results of that incident. We have a serious racial divide that still exists in our county.
And until we get to the point of talking about it, talking about what brought it about, and the aftermath of it, nothing's going to be done. There's that huge gap. There's no understanding of each other. And until we get to that point, lynching is going to have, it's like a stab in the heart.
Lynchings provide an opportunity for us to go to very specific places. Many of these acts of terror took place on courthouse lawns, in front of schools, in front of churches, in front of places that still exist today. So we've been asking people in the community to engage in acts of truth-telling and acts of recovery, reconciliation, reparation. I think we need that in this country. In South Africa, you've seen that. In Rwanda, you've seen that. In Germany, you've seen that. I think they're healthier communities because they acknowledge their histories of mass atrocity and violence. I think we're less healthy because we haven't talked about lynching. And I think to get there, we're going to have to do these tasks. We're going to have to take these steps. And the community involvement, the soil collections are part of that process.
We did this soil collection up here at the Towson, at the old Baltimore County Jail in Towson. A young man by the name of Howard Cooper had been, you know, similar story, accused of molesting a white young woman. He was found guilty in a trial. He was tried in Baltimore City. The jury, it took less than a minute to find him guilty. They never even left the courtroom. He was sent back up to Towson. His lawyers were preparing an appeal based on his 14th Amendment rights. There were no blacks on the panel. And so the locals decided they didn't want to wait for that. And so I think the story is about 75 men, masked men, on the night of July 14th, 1885, stormed the jail, pulled him out, and hung him right there on the spot. They waited until after midnight because they didn't want to lynch him on God's Day. It was a Sunday. They didn't want to lynch him on the Lord's Day. So we did this soil collection, you know, in February, and it was a really, I thought it was a very solemn and touching kind of event. One of the people that was in attendance is a graduate student of history at Stevenson College, and she went and did some research in the census records after that to see if she could find anything about Howard Cooper. So Howard Cooper was lynched in 1885. She found him in the 1870 census. She found him. He had a twin brother. He had another sibling, I think, parents and an aunt living in the same house. He was listed in 1870 as being 6 months old, which means at the time of his lynching, he might have been 14 years old.
Where is the soil from that Towson place now?
Well, we collected the soil, and now it's in the it's on display, along with soil collected all over the country at the Legacy Museum in Montgomery.
And is that the plan for your memorial project, is to have more soil collections?
Yeah, so there's a lot of things we want to do, right? One is that we want to make sure that all of these lynchings are documented, and we want to make sure that they're publicly acknowledged. Yes, we're going to collect soil where we can, and so it'll be on display there. It'll be part of that memorial there. But we also want to make sure that there are public acknowledgments. I would like to get a plaque for Howard Cooper about Howard Cooper's lynching right there at the jail. There are these other memorial columns that are to be claimed by the counties. I would like to get Baltimore County's monument and have it right there in front of the courthouse. People need to be reminded. That's important. And so,
and you'd like to do this throughout Maryland at all these sites?
We'd like to do this throughout Maryland at all these sites. And yes, we want to not only document these, we want them publicly acknowledged, and we want to dignify the lives of these people. Every time I drive by that old jail now in Towson, I can't help but think of his mother, who had to come by the next day and collect his body. 14-year-old kid. That's why it's important to keep investigating and remembering these things. You know, someone once said, very few people alive today are responsible for any of these lynchings. But I think everyone is responsible for remembering them.
In your ambition to memorialize each of these lynching victims around the state, do you expect or have you received any pushback on the idea of a plaque or a memorial to such a hideous act?
Yes. For instance, I discussed with some people putting up a memorial, a plaque at the old Baltimore County Jail where Howard Cooper was lynched. It is owned by Baltimore County, but it is it's an office building. They've had it made into an office. So it's a place of business. And there is some resistance to having a reminder of a hideous crime like that, you know, in the parking lot of a place where people do business. I think it makes it that much more important. I think the whole point of these is that people should be reminded.
We've denied this history for a long time. I think we've become such a punitive society. We have the highest rate of incarceration in the world. I think a lot of people are afraid to talk about slavery, afraid to talk about lynching and segregation, because they fear they'll be punished. We don't have an interest in punishing America for this history, but we don't believe we can be free until we acknowledge this history. Issues of police violence, issues of discrimination, issues of lack of diversity are rooted in an absence of truth-telling about our history. And so we have to just persuade people that there's something powerful and positive and beautiful that can come when we acknowledge these histories, however painful, and make our ways forward. Germany is a nation that we trust more today because they don't have statues to Adolf Hitler. They don't celebrate the Nazis. Rwanda is a healthier place because they've acknowledged that legacy. So is South Africa. I think America has to replicate that if we're going to really be free. We are really burdened by this legacy, and I don't think we've acknowledged it adequately. We terrorized African Americans at the end of the 19th century and through half of the 20th century. The demographic geography of this nation was shaped by this era of racial terror and lynching. The black people who went to Cleveland and Chicago and Detroit went there as refugees and exiles from terror. And we haven't owned up to it, and I think we need to.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. From housing and education to healthcare and employment, they will help you fight to make the biggest difference in your community. Join the fight at uwcm.org/fight.
It's interesting that Confederate monuments are coming down at the time you and the EJI are pushing to have memorials go up to those who were victimized by this reign of terror that occurred around the same time the monuments were going up, right? You can look at the calendar for the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, the increase in the number of lynchings, and the erection of these monuments throughout and cities throughout the South and the Middle Atlantic and in the North.
Right. There's an incredible correlation between when those monuments went up and when the lynchings happened.
The great evil of American slavery wasn't involuntary servitude or forced labor. I believe the great evil of American slavery was the narrative of racial difference that we created to legitimate it. And because we didn't address that in the 13th Amendment, I don't think slavery ended. I think it just evolved. And what we did in this country is we began to criminalize black people in the late 19th century. Convict leasing was a new kind of slavery where we put black people in jails and prisons and then leased them to do the same work they would have done as enslaved people. And that narrative of criminality was very much behind a lynching, even though black people were being lynched for things like not using the colored entrance, for asking for better wages, for scolding white children. Elizabeth Lawrence was lynched in Birmingham, Alabama, because she told white kids to stop throwing stones at her. And even though these acts were not crimes, they challenged this racial hierarchy. They challenged this narrative of racial difference. And so we use the apparatus of punishment, the narrative of punishment, to carry out these lynchings. And when lynchings were shut down because of federal pressure, they moved indoors. And we had a criminal justice system and still have a criminal justice system that operates where too often there are presumptions of dangerousness and guilt that get assigned to black and brown people. The wrongful convictions, the over-incarceration of people of color, these disparities in sentencing are rooted in this history of criminalizing and demonizing people of color that is made most dramatic in this era of lynching. And I think if we understand it, we'll do better at overcoming it. But we have to understand it first, and that's why these projects on slavery and lynching, for me, are so critical.
There are lots of reasons why this is important. It's important because it's still that era, that domestic terrorism, which is what it was, still has a profound effect on the lives of all of us, not just black people, on all of us in this country. I think we should all want to live in a country, in a community, in a state where people can live with dignity, where there's justice. Reconciliation begins with remembering. One of the things that Bryan Stevenson likes to say is that, you know, truth and reconciliation are sequential. You have to know the truth and tell the truth before there can be reconciliation. That's what our mission is. We're telling the truth so that we can hopefully reconcile. It's not something that we're going to be able to finish in a day. Right, it's a long-term project. I did a program several years ago about NASA's mission to Mars, and you know, it's an audacious kind of even concept. I mean, who would even think about that? It literally spans generations. There's so much involved, and one of the scientists, when we interviewed him, he said the way he looked at it is, he said it's like building a cathedral. The people who built cathedrals, they knew that they weren't going to be around to see it finished, but they believe in the vision, they believe in the beauty, and in the worthiness of the effort. So I kind of see this goal as our cathedral of our time, and this is the part that we've been given. One of the things that actually has been most gratifying about this whole effort is how people have found us. Honestly, I'm stunned. Based on a very small article in The Sun before we did the Cooper soil collection, I've been getting phone calls, I've been getting email. I don't know how it's happening. This was even before we had a website or even a formal organization. But people are interested in this. Right? People understand. I think we're having a moment in this country. I think people are starting to realize, you know, I think it's a perverse irony of the times that we're in, of the, you know, this political reality that we have. People realize that no one is going to take us by the hand and lead us to the garden of racial conciliation. It's up to us. And I think people are motivated to do that. And I think I think that's one of the things that made this conference so successful, is because it's a groundswell. And we want to make sure that everyone is invited to be part of this. It's not a top-down kind of a thing. This is, you know, we welcome the participation of people from all over the state. And we've gotten the participation of people from all over the state. So if people want to get involved, I would urge them to visit our website, MarylandLynchingMemorial.org. It's MDLynchingMemorial.org, and learn about what we're doing. And of course, if they want to support the work, that would be great too.
Will, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Will Schwartz is a Baltimore-based video producer and filmmaker who has been working with Bryan Stevenson's Equal Justice Initiative to gather and display soil from Maryland lynching sites for the National Memorial in Montgomery, Alabama, and to get the counties where lynchings occurred to recognize that history. You can find a link to Will's documentary short on the lynching of George Armwood in the notes with today's episode. You can also find links to The Sun's multimedia report on Maryland lynchings and previous episodes of Roughly Speaking on the subject. I'm Dan Rodericks at the Baltimore Sun. For producers Steve Early and Hallie Miller, thanks for listening to our show, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes the writing collective Unruly Catholic Women Writers for a reading and discussion of their new anthology, Unruly Catholic Nuns, Sister Stories. Sister Stories explores the voices of current and former Catholic nuns, and by doing so, contributes to the global conversation about the role of women in the Catholic Church today. Sunday, October 28th at 5 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.